put my hand back in my lap, wondering what I'd just shown her. "Do you know an air artist who'd do anything for you? Someone you'd trust with your life?" she asked. "Yes." Then the lady detailed exactly how to steal fire, like Prometheus did when he stole from the gods. Only I wouldn't be stealing it for all mankind. I'd be stealing it to save myself. She told me in painstaking detail how to catch lightning, how to capture it in a net of air, how to send it careening into my body. "You must hit the heart. Only the heart."
"Why?"
My voice shook. "Why? You ask why? What if the lightning hit your arm? What if it entered your belly or your elbow? Do you think you could make fire from your elbow?" She laughed, but she wasn't laughing at me. "If you want to be transformed into a fire girl, then you have to be transformed. And so does the lightning."
"What does that mean?"
"You can't make beautiful plumes of fire with ordinary lightning. If you were just struck, even in the heart, you'd simply be one of those people who's struck by lightning. Someone whose body runs a few degrees higher. You'd be someone who loses a bit of hearing, or maybe some peripheral vision. You don't want to be a lightning strike survivor, Arya. You want to be a fire artist. You want to change your DNA." She tapped my chest, poking her knobby finger against my sternum. "And so the lightning must meet the air first. The air from another elemental artist. The man-made air turns the lightning into a carrier of elemental gifts. And when it hits your heart, the fire then becomes yours. A part of you. It becomes everything you want it to be. Fire that could shield me. Fire that could protect me. Fire that could save me. The only thing is, it won't last," the lady said, creaking back and forth in her swing. My feet swung gently too. "You will be striking a Faustian bargain, my child. You will be Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill over and over. Your stolen fire will never last. You'll burn out every few months and lose your control. You'll have to get it back. And sometimes the fire you bring into your heart is too much, so you let a little bit loose, or else it will smother you. You will do this in the water. You'll have to do this over and over, every year, then a few times a year. And each time, a piece of your heart will become charred, until eventually it's turned to ash. My life for my life. That seemed a fair price to pay. Chapter 6. Ice Sister. My mother points to her bookshelves, just a few feet away from her chair.
"The one on New York. Can you hand me the one on New York?"
"Do you want to get it?" I ask gently. She shakes her head. Her eyes look like those of a mouse being met by a cat. I reach for the hard-bound book of pictures and hand her the heavy volume, a photographic journey through New York City over the years. The library binding crinkles around the corner. My brother picked this up for her at a bargain basement library sale a few weeks ago. He's at the library a lot for his community service. The three of us have even looked at it together a few times, and it feels good to have all of us back in this house again, even though things aren't the same as they were before.
"Show me your favorite."
I crouch down near her shapeless form, which merges with the cushion. She's not fat. She's tiny. She eats very little. And she's simply soft all over, like the air seeped out of her, and now she's a raft languishing deflated on the side of a pool. My mother used to be beautiful. There's a framed photo on my dad's nightstand of her standing on a fountain in the middle of an outdoor mall. She looks like she's in mid-dance step, jaunty and sassy, with a short black-and-white dress whisking around her thighs. She's playful in the picture, her eyes sparkling and teasing as if she's saying, "I can make a fountain too." She opens the book and flips slowly through the pages. Central Park, of course. And the New York Public Library. And Broadway. I bet Broadway is amazing, she says dreamily, then hums a few bars, maybe from a show tune or maybe just a made-up number in her head. Someday, we'll see a Broadway show, she used to tell me. We'll go to a musical, all decked out to the nines, nails done, and best shoes on, tickets we saved up for months in our hands. But this is my favorite, she says as she turns another few pages and shows me a picture of Grand Central Station. It's swarming with people fanning out in all directions. I wonder if she's trying to tell me something, that she longs to be around people again, that she craves escape too. I want to tell her that New York would be perfect. Maybe we'd even run into the beautiful boy. I hear the sound of the shower from the lone bathroom down the hall. My father is in there. My mother closes the book. We could go there someday, Mom, I whisper. I'm getting stronger every day. Maybe I'll be recruited, and we can take a trip to New York. Something flashes in her eyes for the faintest of moments. Hope? I continue, keeping my voice low. They have the best doctors there, you know, in New York. We could find someone to treat you. My mom's never been to New York. She's from Nebraska, grew up right in the heartland, in a tiny little town, nothing but wheat and corn and red rusty pickup trucks. Then she just up and got the hell out of town. That's how she told the story of her exodus. The first girl in her family to go to college, to a university in Miami. Nebraska is an icebox. Don't let that middle-of-the-country thing fool you, she said when I was in second grade. She tapped the map of the United States that was tacked to our hallway wall and crouched down to my height. It's no place for a water girl. In the winters, the cold smacks your face and bites your skin. Everything is frozen. The horizon is gray as far as you can see. The way she tells the story, you'd think she'd packed a few swimsuits into a bandana, wrapped that around a stick, and hitched all the way to the Sunshine State. The day after graduation, I walked out the door and turned my back on Nebraska. I had a destination, and I had some determination, so I trekked right across the country and then down south as the ocean called out to me. I needed to be near waves and warm water and seas I could dive into year-round, she said, sweeping her index finger along the mapped edge of Florida's coastline, as if I needed the reminder that we lived on a big toe surrounded by blue. But I watched her hands, mesmerized by the way she could weave both water and words, how every move of her body, every ordinary gesture, even her hand trailing along a laminated map, was a ballet. Now she's camped out on a papasan chair and hasn't felt the sun on her skin in years, stricken by some mystery ailment that's handcuffed her to the house and turned her into a shell of the woman she once was. She doesn't even talk the same. They do, Mom. The doctors in New York, they'll be able to figure out what's wrong, I say, trying desperately to plant the seed of escape in her. Maybe we can do more than visit New York. Maybe a doctor can heal her, and then she can protect Jana from our dad. Or better yet, she can leave him and be the mom she used to be. She can take care of Jana. She waves a hand, like she's swatting away an errant bug. Don't worry about me. But don't you want to? They have medicine for panic disorders.
There are things you can take, you know. I've researched it. I've looked it up.
Her eyes harden, as they do whenever I name it. The thing that pins her down.
Arya, can you go fetch me my newspaper? I want to read the latest on how the lookout stopped that tropical storm brewing in the Caribbean, she says.
The lookouts are the teams of elemental artists who help fight forest fires and turn hurricanes into tropical storms. Elemental artists can't control Mother Nature, but they can help quell her when she slouches toward disaster. The lookouts are the reason neither Florida nor any other state has been battered by anything greater than a Category 1 or 2 storm in the last several years. The reason why brush fires in Los Angeles last for hours now instead of days.
Yes, Mom. I'll get you the paper.
I open the front door, where I'm greeted by a blast of morning heat. I walk to the end of the driveway, grab the newspaper, and bring it to my mom.
Thank you, my love,
she says, then kisses me on the cheek and opens the paper, closing the conversation. When I return to my room, I kneel by my bed and pull out an orange crate that holds my fashion magazines. I don't read them for tips on what to wear. I like to draw on the models instead. I give them tails and longer noses or cartoon eyes and extra hands. Nothing fancy. Nothing that would make comic book artists quake in their boots. But they're mine. They're my graffiti. And I like to keep them, to look at them when I need a laugh. They've served their purpose many times, after many returns from the garage, when all I could do was use my wrists to flip through pages of my mustachioed models waggling cigars from their pouty lips and quipping cartoon-bubbled sayings. Get your fish and chips here! And other ridiculous things. Inside one of the magazines is a worn-out sheet of paper I've kept there for more than 3 years. It's full of dates, including the one I marked on it 2 nights ago, the night I lost my fire. The night I regained my fire. The night my fire started to eat me alive. Again.
What if hair could feel?
What if?
Do you think my hair can feel your hands? Janna asks me as I weave another section of her rabbit-soft brown hair into a French braid. She's folding a flyer from last night's show into a makeshift fan.
Well, I hope you can feel my hands, dork.
No, I mean really feel. Like details. Like your...
Shh.
Why?
She finishes the fan, then waves it in front of her face to cool off. It's hot and then some in our house, but proximity to me makes her toastier.
Don't. But I can. I can feel the ridges a little bit.
Anyway, I say, cutting her off. What are you going to do today? She shrugs.
There's nothing to do. I hate summer vacation.
Words you rarely hear from a 12-year-old.
Well, it's boring when you're 12 and don't have a phone or a car and your mom won't drive you anywhere and your sister is gone all the time.
It's not as if I love all-day practices either when school's out.
Anyway, what's Mindy doing?
I don't know.
Well, call her, I say. Mindy is Kyle's little sister.
It's too early. She's never up this early.
Text her. Use my phone. In my pocket. I loop another strand of hair as Janna reaches into my pocket. Her hand is cold and it tickles. I wriggle a bit. She laughs, then sends a message.
I'll call you when she writes back, okay?
What if you're on fire?
Janna teases. Then I guess you'll never know what Mindy wants to do today, silly, I say as I wrap the end of the braid in a tight rubber band.
There. Beautiful.
Janna leans back into me, and I wrap my arms around her. Do you want to go pool hopping tonight? She turns her face to me and grins.
You'll go with me?
Sure. I think the Markins are out of town for a few weeks. We can sneak into their yard.
Jana beams. I love pool hopping with you.
I know, because you're a fish.
Maybe I should just go to the beach today.
I tense.
Okay, but don't tell Dad.
Why?
I lower my voice. Because he'll ask a million questions. You know he will. He'll want to know if you turned into a dolphin or something.
Maybe I am a dolphin, Jana says, and flashes me a smile, her teeth white and bright and perfectly straight.
You might be, but don't tell him. Promise me, okay?
I whisper, tightening my arms around her, gripping her as if I can protect her this way. With her promise, with a hope, with a wish.
I promise, she tells me.
Time to go, my father barks from the driveway. I jump up.
I'll draw a dolphin on your arm later if you're nice to Mom today. I'll even give him sideburns,
I say as I give Jana a kiss on the forehead, then grab my bag as she tells me no sideburns ever.
I rush out, shouting goodbye to my mom, who's working the crossword puzzle now.
Xavier is still snoring, lying on his stomach, with one arm dangling off the side of the couch. The back of his hand glares at me, marked with a dark X, etched like a tattoo. I slide into the front seat of my dad's car, a 1970 Pontiac GTO he restored a few years ago with parts that had come into the junkyard he runs. He also had one of his car cronies lay a pair of flame decals on the sides. They're hideous.
Did you sleep well last night?
He twists his gaze behind him as he backs out of the driveway.
Like a baby.
Do you feel rested today?
Totally.
I told Nava you need to work on control exercises.
What a surprise.
You do. I want pristine control, Aria.
I'm sure.
Don't be sarcastic with me.
I wasn't being sarcastic. I meant it. I'm sure you want pristine control. I have no doubt you want perfect, rigorous, pristine, impeccable control. And you'll get it, so don't worry.
I don't worry. You are the most talented fire artist there is.
I am, and I like to think it's because I train so hard. I work harder than anyone, but maybe that's just to make up for my crime. Maybe I can never make up for it. Maybe I'm only good because I'm not natural.
Silence fills the car for a few minutes, but at least the air is cool inside these four doors. When my dad fixed up this car, he fixed the AC in it too. I take a pen from the front of my backpack and draw a stick figure blowing up TNT on my thigh.
Don't do that, my dad says.
I ignore him, bending my head lower to ink out a cartoon explosion. Thighs are wonderful inventions with their dual purpose. They propel us quickly if we work them, and they also provide magnificent, omnipresent canvases.
Why do you do that?
I say nothing. This, silence, the occasional snark, is all I have to fight back, to show him that he hasn't broken me. He relents.
Someone's coming in today to pick through our stock of Fords. Should be a good day. We have a lot of those,
he says in an offhand way, as if I care about his love of cars.
Fords.
That's great.
I'm betting we'll clear 1,000.
Fabulous.
Wouldn't it be, though?
He turns toward me at the red light. I try not to look at him. Yes, money's awesome. If I'm recruited into the leagues, I plan to save every last dime and use it to steal again. To steal my mom and my sister and my brother away from my dad. Chapter 7. Secrets and Shortstops. I walk through the doors of the training facility. The air conditioning grinds louder as I pass through. It's heat-sensitive, so the AC's working harder, sensing the rise in temperature. I head for the old bullpen, where I practice.
Nava is thrilled with my precision and my stunningly beautiful flames.
Beauty is always rewarded,
Nava says after my flames soar higher than they ever have, curling into lush tails like a peacock's fan spread open.
That seems like some sort of wise old adage that is supposed to mean something but really doesn't,
I say, teasing her, feeling light and fun again now that I'm back in control.
What? You don't like my adages? How about, you will obtain your goal if you maintain the course?
Now you're just a fortune cookie, Nava. I thought you didn't even like Chinese food.
She puts a hand on her heart in mock indignation. Not like Chinese food? All my people love Chinese food. Of course I love it.
Do they have Chinese food in Israel?
No, we had to go pluck all our food straight from the fields. We had to yank carrots from the ground and shoot arrows into rabbits if we wanted to eat.
Oh, ha-ha.
Well, you asked a silly question, so you got a silly answer,
she says as we continue to work through my moves out in the bullpen.
But yeah, of course we had convenience stores and Chinese restaurants in Tel Aviv. But I hear it's all changed since then.
You mean since the Middle East became the ME?
Nava nods. Since the treaty, yes. I mean, there are still convenience stores and Chinese food, but everything else changed, and for the better, of course. When I talk to my cousins who are still there, they tell me how wonderful it is to walk the streets and not fear getting shot or bombed.
Do you ever want to go back?
I'm a Florida girl now. Florida's been good to me.
Besides, Florida will be good to you too, Aria. Yuck, I can't stand Florida, I say. But unlike Nava, I've never even been anyplace else.
I hope you might like Miami,
she says in this coy, flirty voice. And I turn to her, my eyes wide. What do you mean, Nava? Her voice has a playful glint to it.
Just that Miami, if it works out, might be a nice place for you to spend a few months.
I spin toward her, my veins filling with hope. Am I going to Miami? Do the ME leagues want me? She holds up her slender hands and laughs.
I don't know. But what I do know is this. I took a phone call this afternoon from a certain scout from the ME leagues who's had his eye on our team and a few of our artists in particular.
And?
I feel like I may rocket to the moon with excitement, that I might very well learn I have wings and can fly. And it's a good thing your control is better because he'll be here on Friday.
I give Nava a massive hug, grinning. She pats my back, and I can tell she's smiling too, and I'm so deliriously happy that a tear slides down my cheek.
Nava pulls back, mistaking it as worry. You'll be fine. Don't worry, you're ready.
I nod, collecting myself.
I so rarely let emotion show.
I return to my usual stoicism. Does my dad know yet? Nava shakes her head.
I'll call him later and tell him. I wanted you to know first.
I have a secret. Sure, it has an expiration date in a few hours, but it feels so good. I turn back to the concrete wall, thinking of my dad, of all the ways he's hurt me. I throw a massive fireball that spins on its path to the concrete. For the briefest of seconds, I swear my fire has the faint outlines of a pair of eyes. Then it hits the wall and disappears. Maybe I imagined it. Elise and I walk through the weight room on the way in from the field. The room is filled with grunts and the clangs of iron bars going up and down, as well as with glares from the ballplayers. The shortstop is the only one who doesn't stare us down. Instead, he manages the tiniest of smiles, and it makes his blue eyes crinkle in a cute and kind of sexy way. I'm not even sure what his name is, but I'm glad he's on the team. Elise cups her hands over my ear.
Listen, I heard from some of my friends in the ME leagues. The scout wants something big.
Something special.
Like what? Like the legendary Fire Twin? I suggest. Though I'm joking because the Fire Twin is a trick that hasn't been seen in several years.
Well, if you could do that, then yes. If you want to get out of town, you need to wow him.
So what should I do that's epic? The spinning wheel trick? The starlight? I don't know if I have time to develop a new trick.
Can you combine two? Like marry the arc that you do with starlight?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, but is that enough? I ask, and my voice sounds like a squeak, tripping on my own desperation.
Talk to Nava. I'll make some calls. We'll come up with something. Maybe ask Xavi?
I scoff. Yeah, he knows all the right tricks.
But what about you?
Elise laughs dryly, a quick laugh. You know I don't stand a chance with a scout.
Plus, my parents want me in the lookouts, not the leagues.
I know, I say. I've known this for years. Her parents always saw the Wonder Team as a feeding ground for the lookouts. But Elise and I are more than a team. I can't survive without her. Elise is a year older than I am, but we've been best friends for years and nearly inseparable throughout high school. The good thing is, since she's going to college in Miami, we can still meet up for renewals if I'm recruited. We leave the weight room, stairs following us.
Go Mud Dogs!
Elise shouts, pumping a fist as the door swings shut. Then a shrug.
They already hate us.
Not all of them.
Well, the non-haters are nice, especially the shortstop.
He's definitely a babe.
You should go for it.
Ha, I say, because I don't do that. I don't go for it when it comes to boys. Going for it could lead to getting it, and then where would I be? Stuck with someone who'd want to know me, who I'd want to tell all my secrets to. I don't want to share my secrets because I don't trust anyone but Elise. So I don't get too close to boys. They belong in photos on my phone. Not closer. Never closer. My father holds his index finger to his lips when I walk inside that night. He tips his forehead to the chair. My mom is sleeping.
She just fell asleep,
he whispers, his voice like a pillow when he talks of her. He says this as if it's some wondrous mystery that my mother is sleeping. My mother is the queen of sleeping. Yet everything about her somehow enchants him. He tends to her, brushes her hair, runs the bath for her. Sometimes it seems as if he'd do anything for her. To keep her. The coddling, the kid gloves he wears with her are such a contrast to how he is with me. Okay, I say in a whatever kind of tone, and head to the kitchen for a glass of water. He rises from the couch and follows me, padding quietly.
Aren't you excited for the scout?
I shrug as I run the tap and drink some water. I am excited, but I will never let on in front of him.
This is what we've been working for, Aria. This is what all our hard work has been leading to.
I tense, holding my hands behind my back. I clutch my fingers, linking them together, as if that will keep my hands safe.
Are you ready for Friday?
Totally. I won't let him know the scout wants a big trick. If I tell him that, he'll burn me again, as if his matches might elicit something new and magnificent from my hands.
You need to be amazing on Friday, and I know you can be. You can. And then we can get air conditioning, and we can get a new chair.
He looks at my mom sadly, but with so much regret and love in his eyes that he seems like a different person. His voice slips and he covers his eyes. If he were a real father, I'd comfort him. I'd tell him I want mom to be okay too. But I don't want to get her a new chair. I want to get her a new life, and I want him out of mine. I soften, but not for him. For mom. For Jana. For Xavi.
The leagues are my path to their freedom.
It's okay, Daddy. I'll be great. I promise.
He hugs me, and I pretend to stumble on an unseen pebble so he can't hold on. I step away from him, doing my best to appear flustered by my clumsiness. Chapter 8. A New Trick. I lie awake as I walk myself through each trick, each move, and the amount of fire I must trigger, from the tiniest flicks for starlight to the all-encompassing flames of the fireworks finale. Maybe Elise is right. Maybe I can combine them somehow. Big and small. Power and precision. Jana is asleep in the bed next to mine. She didn't want to go pool hopping tonight. Said she was too tired. I get up, walk to her bed, and kneel near her sleeping body. She's deep in slumber, and her face looks so soft. I wonder if she's dreaming of dolphins, or friends, or buried treasure. Or maybe another time and another place. Or another life, as I do. I take her hand in mine. It's cold. I tense, but when I place my other hand on her chest, I'm reassured with her breathing. So why is her hand so cold? It's broiling outside, even at this hour. It's the middle of the night, and the sky is still weeping muggy heat. But her hand is icy, like it was this morning when she reached for my phone. Could Jana be an ice artist? I flash back to what I've read about the rare breed of water artists who don't just weave waves and command streams. They are a strain who create not only water, but ice. It'd be a great party trick to make those swan ice sculptures you see at brunches. But the talent is much more than a party trick. It's an uncommon gift among only a handful of water artists. The power to freeze your own water. I shake Jana, wake her up.
"What?"
she mutters in a muffled voice. Her eyes flutter open, then close again.
"Jana,"
I say in a firm whisper.
"Jana."
She shifts.
"What?"
"Jana, why are your hands so cold?"
"Huh?"
She flips to her other side, trying to pull herself back into dreams. "Jana, is Dad doing something to your hands?"
"Dipping them in ice? Trying to freeze her?"
"No," she says, and shifts back to the other side.
"No,"
she adds. "Okay," I say, and slip back to my bed, under my own covers. But when I peer over at Jana, she's not asleep anymore. She's staring up at the ceiling. Xavier wakes me at 5:30 and tells me we are going to ride together. Xavier hates mornings. If he's awake at this hour, it means he wants to talk. I change into workout clothes and pull on fingerless bike gloves so my palms won't dig into the handlebars. We ride hard through the blue light of the fading moon. The headlight on my bike glares on the concrete, and I pedal faster, keeping pace with my brother, who must have worked out during the 4 years he spent locked up. He's in shape like a whip, lean and taut. His hands wrap around the slim handlebars of his old road bike. Those X marks on his hands stare at me as we speed through the dawn, along the frontage road, underneath the freeway, far past the edges of wonder. I was drawn to his marks the first time I saw them, the first time I visited him behind bars. He told me they branded him the second he walked through the doors of the penitentiary, even though he was a juvenile, just 17 when he was locked up. But his crime warranted the punishment of an adult, so that's what he was given. 4 years, and permanent marks. Arson will do that to you. The first time I saw him, I gawked at the black X's, a sign he used his powers for a crime. "Your hands," I said, pointing.
"As if a little mark can stop me,"
he whispered darkly.
Tell me about life on the outside. Have you set the world on fire yet, too?
I hadn't had my own hands set on fire yet. No, I said. I don't think I'm anything. I don't think I'm like you or Dad. Xavier had been a beautiful fire artist. He had woven flames as if he were conducting an orchestra. He'd been on the Wonder Team since he was 13, the earliest a fire artist had ever performed in the Southern Farm Circuit. I went to all his shows, sat in the front row, and followed him around like the proverbial puppy dog. But Xavier liked fire too much. He'd disappear after shows sometimes, and when he returned home a few hours later, he'd rap on my door and tell me what he'd done, like a confession, but guilt-free.
I lit a fireball in a tree, watched it flame up for a few minutes.
Then what?
Put it out, of course.
Next, it was garbage cans, then a few dumpsters. Each time, he'd put out his own flames. He didn't want to get caught. But maybe he did. I don't know. All I know is he became careless, or angry, or proud, because he started setting cars on fire. Cars he'd find in empty lots late at night. Cars parked along the beach after midnight. He'd set them aflame, watch them burn, and then douse his own fire, leaving behind the charred remains. I'm not entirely sure what drove him to my dad's junkyard one night. Maybe he had a beef with dear old Dad, too. When he returned, he woke me up, told me the story of how he watched the cars burn, how he presided over them, inhaling the smell of the burning tires, noxious and thick, and the scent of the seatbelt smoking. How he watched as a dented, faded red door slowly peeled away from a Mustang. Dad's favorite model. Then he extinguished the flames. My dad was the first to see the destruction, and he crafted a cover-up for his boss and for the fire department. He claimed a lit cigarette had wreaked the havoc, even though he didn't smoke. But he needed to protect his son, his first hope for fame, for money, for glory. Besides, it was a junkyard, a wayward land for broken-down parts, smashed-up pieces, and really, a cigarette being flicked there could have done that kind of damage. It was plausible enough. When our dad yelled at Xavier for what he'd done, my brother just said,
"What do you expect? You gave me your fire. You made me this way."
Xavier laid waste to many more cars in our town. Late at night, like some sort of avenging ghost rider, he'd pace down the streets, flick his wrist, and watch Fords and Buicks and Cadillacs ignite. He was arrested quickly for the car bombings. Xavier Calandros wasn't just a fire artist. It was as if the fire in him had twisted too far, forked in on itself, and made him destructive. Then again, that may be what fire powers do to us. That may be another part no one understands. That behind our hardened skin, we are driven mad by our so-called gifts. Xavier has been out of prison for 1 month now. Sometimes I wonder if my dad would have set my hands aflame if Xavi hadn't been locked up. If Xavi had continued performing and rising to the top of the leagues. If my dad had another fire artist, a true and pure one to focus his energy on. But then, maybe my dad was programmed, in his own sick way by his father, to hurt his kids. I don't blame my brother for anything. I'm just happy that he's home. He takes a sharp right and guides us onto a long stretch of empty road, only a few houses on each side. The homes thin out more, and we pass an orange grove, then a field. Soon he turns on a hard-packed dirt road, and I grip my handlebars tighter because the wheels of this bike weren't made for roads like this. I'm looking down, and I barely notice where we are. The abandoned mental asylum in nearby Winter Springs.
Why are you taking me here?
I'll show you why.
We pedal up the road that leads to what was once a serene and tranquil setting for those who'd lost their minds. a sprawling mansion that a Florida couple donated to the state for a mental institution, in memory of their daughter who'd suffered from schizophrenia. The Elizabeth Jane Hansen Center for Respite and Care. It was like a stately southern plantation, but now its big, wide steps are cracked and crumbling. The once white home has turned gray and dirty, like an unwashed back windshield begging wash me in fingerprint. The grounds are overgrown with grass, unkempt and wild. The massive front doors have fallen off their hinges, and they hang open, lifeless. A Florida sugar maple tree's untrimmed branches poke into a broken window on the second floor, as if the tree had been grabbing blindly for what lay beyond. Xavier and I walk through the broken-down doors. Inside, the mansion is dead silent and still as glass. I wrap a hand around Xavier's arm, and he ushers me up the stairs, the walls lined with old portraits hanging limply at sad angles. I peek into one of the patient rooms on the second floor. A basin has fallen on its side, with brittle bits of porcelain trailing from its bowl. Another room contains medical equipment, an old gurney, withered over the years, and a series of bizarre contraptions with straps and buckles that must have been for restraint.
"That's where they housed the especially crazy ones,"
Xavier says, as if he can hear my thoughts. Xavier leads me into a larger room that must have once been the baths. We're surrounded by the shells of old tubs and the carcasses of showers and sinks, with dust and dirt under our feet. I cough. He lets go of me and turns in a full circle, his arms spread out.
"This is where I will make fire again."
I half want to smack him. "You're crazy! And you're a jerk for taking me here for that reason."
"I'm serious, R. There's a bunch of us who are forbidden from making elemental arts, but we're going to do it here. I visited this place after work the other night, and it's perfect. Off the grid, you know. No one ever comes here, but we'll have our own shows here. A new kind of show."
"Like a rave? Some underground theater spectacle?" He nods enthusiastically, and his eyes have the glint of an inventor. "Why would anyone come here, though? Why would they see a show here when there are shows in less creepy places?"
"Because we don't make the same magic anymore."
"What do you make?" I ask with a sick curiosity. Maybe he has a trick to teach me that will get me out of town. Anticipation balloons in my lungs.
"Watch,"
he says, and takes a few steps back. He holds out his hands, the gorgeous way he used to when he stood in the same park where I'll perform for the scout. He spreads them like a magician. As if they're steely knives, he slashes his arms through the air, releasing plumes of fire. I watch, mesmerized, as the flames race to the ceiling high above us. Then he calls them back down before they burn a thing. But on their descent, I notice something amiss about his flames. They're taking shape. They're curving and curling. And when he relights them, they are more defined. They are forming his mirror image. He made a fire twin. He made the legendary trick that hasn't been seen in years. One that's whispered of, talked about in hushed tones. One that's supposedly incredibly hard to execute. I am frozen, speechless. I point at him, barely able to comprehend what he's made. A flaming, shadowy replica of himself. Tall and sinewy like Xavier, shimmering next to him, mirroring him. Arms moving as Xavier's arms move. Lips curving into a grin as Xavier's do. A burning carbon copy of my brother, the arsonist.
"Hugh, you're making..."
But that's all I can say.
"Cool, huh?"
His face is lit up like a child's. So is his twin's. It's creepy but completely mesmerizing. He steps toward me. His duplicate steps too. I back away, but I can't look elsewhere. I can't stop staring, not as he raises a hand and beckons me closer to him, as they both do. I shake my head, but then I'm following his twin's lead, inching nearer. His twin's fire is quiet. There's no crackling or hissing from its flames, and there's a part of me that's tempted to stick my own hand through the shadowy copy of my brother. But then, the fire starts to fade, quickly flaming out. The twin is gone. He looks at me with expectant eyes.
You like?
I'm horrified and amazed at the same time. How did you do that?
I learned.
But how? No one has done one in years. You didn't make that when you were in the leagues, I say, as if I can point out the unimaginable in what he's pulled off. Old, dark, elemental magic.
Arya, we can do anything with our gifts if we focus, if we train them.
Did you learn this in prison?
Yes,
he says, his tone light, as if this is all in a day's work for him. How, though? I ask, and I want to clutch his shoulders, demand an answer for the incredible feat he's pulled off. How on earth do you do that? Did it take years? Did you work on this the whole time you were in there?
He shakes his head. Didn't take me long.
Then why doesn't everyone make a fire twin? The leagues have been dying for someone to make a fire twin since the last time a fire artist pulled it off a few years ago.
I have a theory on why I learned it quickly. Because when they make you stop, like in prison, I think the fire or the water or the air or the earth, it builds up in you.
He grabs at his own chest for emphasis.
It builds inside you, and it's like it's all bubbling under the surface, and when you can't let it out, it starts to turn into this. Some of us did this in our cells at night when the guards weren't looking.
I know a little something about fire building inside me. Would my fire turn to a duplicate me if I didn't drown the extra in the canals? And you're going to perform like that?
Yeah. I can make beasts, too. Lizards, snakes, and all sorts of horned creatures,
he says. Those aren't as rare, but audiences don't tend to care for my snakes very much, though some audiences might.
I think there's a certain segment of society that would be pretty game to see the other side of the gifts.
I grab his arm as a new worry punches my chest. Savy, I don't want you to perform here. You might be tempted again.
To burn more cars?
He asks with a raised eyebrow. Yeah, I say as if the answer is obvious, because it is. And I don't want you to be tempted. I don't want you to be sent away. I want you to be safe.
I won't let it get out of control again,
he says, his voice reassuring, but only because I want to be reassured. I want to believe. Because we're the same. We've both broken laws. We've both abused the elements. And the only difference between the two criminals standing in this abandoned insane asylum right now is who's been caught. And because we're both outlaws, I ask him the next question, knowing he'll say yes. I need to know how you do it. Can you teach me?
You want to know?
He says in a rough voice that's part protective and part willing. He's the older brother looking out for me, but he's also the guy who can't resist the dark side. Yes, I say firmly. This is my ticket out of here.
You really want to know how?
Xavier asks again. Yes. He takes a step closer, places his palms on my shoulders. The muscles on his arms are corded and strong.
Or, I can tell you, but you won't like it.
It can't be any worse than anything else, I say, thinking of the smell of my own skin burning in the garage a few nights ago.
It can be.
Tell me. Please tell me.
Or, you want to know why they don't teach you how to do this? Why no one in the leagues or the circuit or anywhere is teaching this?
Xavier is a chemistry professor in a darkened classroom, teaching his morbidly curious student how to mix elements in a most unnatural way. Making sure the student is ready, making sure the pupil can handle the underbelly of the lesson. I am ready.
Why?
Because they don't know how. Because they don't want to even contemplate how. Because of where it comes from. To make the fire bend into the dark shape of yourself, you have to go to a dark place. This type of fire art comes from your fear, from your pain, and most of all, from your anger. It comes from every dark thought you've ever had. Your fire twin is like the manifestation of all your darkness.
Why do you think I learned how to do this while locked up?
Why do you think I learned to do this with the other guys? Because we all have that stored inside us.
Like a gasoline station. Tap into it, and you've got the fuel you need.
Anger? Yeah, I've got gallons and gallons of that. I've got tankers full.
How hard is it to do, though? Is it like a quadruple flip in gymnastics or a quad jump in skating or something?
Yeah, it's hard. But you and me, we've always been the best. We can do the hardest tricks. But the other reason why it's hard and why artists don't want to do it, it messes with your mind. When you go to a dark place, it makes you a dark person.
I'm already that person.
I want to try, I tell him. I flash back to the other day at practice. The faint outline of a pair of eyes I saw when I threw that last fireball at the concrete wall. Thinking of my dad. I know I can do this. 2 hours later. 2 hours of picturing my father and all the ways I've daydreamed about using my powers on him. I've managed a crude outline of arms, legs, the beginnings of my face in fiery form. It does my bidding. It moves with me. This trick could be my ticket to saving everyone.
Chapter 9. Stage Name.
The park is a constant hum, loud and buzzing and beating. The whole crowd is expecting something to happen tonight, even though scouts don't make announcements before the crowd. They run under the radar. They dress like the rest of us. We haven't had an ME League scout visit our team in more than a year. The last time a scout appeared, he was gone the second the show ended. He was impressed with exactly no one. Tonight, the metal bleachers are overflowing, and for the first time this summer, we have a standing room only crowd. I recognize many of them, other guys from the junkyard, friends of mine from school. My history teacher, the track coach, Elise's parents, the woman who sells the old library books at the discount bins on the lawn outside the library, Nava and her parents, the pretty girls from school who rarely come near me, whether because of my fire, my brother, or both. Even Shortstop is here, and he's so damn cute there in the second row. But I don't let a boy distract me as I sweep my eyes over the rest of the crowd. Jana's in the front row, next to our dad, and he keeps trying to hold her hand, and she keeps pulling her hand away. Her hair is still slicked back and wet. He made her spend the whole day at the local pool doing laps. I wish Xavi and my mom were here, but they're not, so I keep my focus on the rest of the team, on Elise as she harnesses a long swath of wind she's created, turning herself in and out of it like a gymnast. Then Corinne, the water girl, who must be terribly nervous tonight, because her fountains are smaller, slighter, and less powerful than usual. Then Angel, who moved here from Orlando, and who can make the earth shake and shimmy. He's tall and wispy, and he barely speaks during team meetings. You'd think a boy with the powers of the earth might like making tremors and cracks. But instead, he's like Ferdinand the Bull in that children's story that I read to Jana many times over when she was younger. Angel likes to make flowers,
growing lilies and roses and daisies that he gives to the ladies in the first row. They giggle and sniff the flowers, and if Angel doesn't make it all the way to the top, I don't know who will. Then it's my turn, and I should be nervous. I should be terrified, and somewhere inside me, I am. But there's a bigger force at play in my body, a razor-sharp desire to leave home. No one ever told me that needing to escape is stronger than love, greater than fear. I figured that out on my own, and I channeled it into my fire. I take my place on the now-and-again pitcher's mound. I begin releasing flames. Streams of fire are reflected in the eyes of the crowd, brilliant streaks that I weave and thread against the dark of the night. Then a circle of flames, like a coil running around my body. Next is an arc of fireworks, a willow tree canopy of sparks around me. I see my father in the crowds, his eyes wild and alive with some sick hope. A dark place. I flash on the garage, the matches, the bandages my hands used to be wrapped in, the wicks of fire that torched my palms the other night. Something flares deep inside me. It collides with the memory of Xavi this morning, with his words, with the trick I practiced. My twin this morning was clunky, but can I pull it off now? As I stare at my father, I know it's in me. After I finish the last trick in the playbook, I go for a coda. Unexpected, unscripted, something I've only managed to do in an abandoned insane asylum. One more raising of the arms, high and tight. One more strike of fire into the night. I will the fire to split off, to replicate. The fire obeys, and I create a crude, rudimentary, shimmery shadow of myself. I bow, and the girl made of flames bows too. Then I snap my fingers, and she disappears in the night. The crowd goes wilder than any crowd has ever gone. If my brother could see me now, I'm sure he'd be thrilled at the wicked grin on my face. A reporter is the first to find me in the dugout. She thrusts a microphone in my face and asks me how I made the twin. "We've heard stories of fire twins, but no one's seen one in years. Not since a fire artist in London made one. How did you do it?" I don't know what to say. I've never been interviewed before. I picture my brother, and I think about what he would say. He'd be cool and witty. "It's just a little something I thought the audience might like," I say, hoping my answer is vague enough. "Have you been working on it for a long time?" "I've definitely been working on it," I say. "But this was the first time you've done it in a show?" I nod. "Will we see more of your twin, Aria?" "I hope so," I say. Then I head to the locker room.
What happened to her hands?
The question comes from the scout. His skin is brown, his hair is black, and his words are accented with his Arab roots. He speaks English flawlessly, and he has other matters on his mind besides my fiery copy. He holds my hands in his, my palms up. I don't like having my hands touched. It makes me feel exposed. I press my lips together and wait. The question is not for me. It's for my father, who stands next to me in the coach's office. Nava is seated in a chair. I feel like a calf at market, the buyer asking the farmer if I've been fed and kept properly, poking my haunches, prodding my belly to see if I'd be a good cut of meat.
"It happens," my father says coolly, casually.
The scout raises an eyebrow. His name is Imran, he told us, and he's been on the circuit since the leagues began, years ago.
"Not like this,"
Imran says, shaking his head. My father holds up his own hands. His palms are craggy and ragged, too, but not like mine. No one has palms as far gone as mine.
It happens with fire artists. It happened to me.
Yes, I know, Imran says, his voice clipped. He is commanding. He is the one in charge here.
But I have never in all my years seen someone so young with so many scars, so many burns.
Arya played with fire a lot when she was younger, my father says in an empty voice. My stomach lurches and I want to lunge at him, to throttle him, to grab his neck and strangle the last bit of life from him. The scout turns to me. The corner of his lips curls up like there's a private joke that might make me laugh.
Is that so?
I rearrange my features, return the mask of steel to my face. Yes, I've always loved fire.